church leaders in Omaha, Nebraska, a long time ago.
You say, let's take a step at a time. This is the smallest step we know of. Dialogue, talking with one another, understanding. Let's not look back on history and say the church had nothing to do when the integration problem was around.
The verdict of history was important for some people of Omaha who allowed cameras to follow their attempts to deal with race relations back in 1965. More than 40 years later, the filmmaker of A Time for Burning and one of the community's most eloquent voices for change join us. Who are they? Hint, neither of them is named Warren Buffett. Racial Oracles of Omaha on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 20th, and it is a fascinating film. And interestingly enough, somebody in it doesn't think things have changed here in America
right,
when
right.
it comes to race relations.
Yeah, somebody has not lost their candor. Good morning, Adora.
Also this morning, John, campaign, the latest on the campaign trail, and a look at a surprisingly close Senate race in Georgia. And what's scarier to Americans, the slumping economy or a terrorist bombing? A dialogue about fear is coming up. Those stories, but first, these headlines.
Prominent Republican now backing Barack Obama. On NBC's Meet the Press, former Secretary of State Colin Powell said it's time for something new.
Senator Obama brings a fresh set of eyes, fresh set of ideas to the table.
Does it change the campaign? We'll have a discussion in a moment. On Sunday, Obama's campaign said it raised a record $150 million in September. That puts the Obama campaign on pace to spend more than Bush and Kerry spent combined in 2004.
That's a lot of money. World markets are trending up this hour. Major Asian indexes closed higher. European indexes are also mostly heading north. Futures trading points to a positive opening. Future trading points to a positive opening for American markets as well. Moving the markets this morning, the Dutch government moved to prop up banking giant ING. Taxpayers in the Netherlands are now on the hook for a $13.4 billion stake in the company.
And here in the States, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke testifies on the Hill today, and investors will be watching for any future Fed action that might be indicated from his remarks. As a new champion in baseball's American League, the Tampa Bay Rays beat the Boston Red Sox last night to advance to the World Series. It's been a long road for Rays owner Stuart Sternberg, whose team was a loser for a decade.
It shows that anything is possible because we really took something from worst to first.
And that's literally true. They are four wins away from being first if they win the World Series, but they have to get by the Philadelphia Phillies. The series begins in Florida on Wednesday.
The Dow closed 1.4% Friday at 88.52. The S&P dropped just over a half point, settling at 940. And oil prices rose about $2 near $74 a barrel in Asian trading.
Still feels low. But Colin Powell is backing Barack Obama. It's a big endorsement from a big Republican and certainly somebody who has the trust of Americans, at least if you look at the polls. What does it mean?
Does it mean anything? Has it changed any minds? Has it changed your mind? Give us your thoughts about the Powell endorsement.
Has an endorsement ever mattered to you one way or another? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Powell goes for Obama, but what do you think?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with the campaign. And while some might have thought the endorsement would have had more impact if it came during the primaries, when former Secretary of State Colin Powell got around to endorsing Barack Obama, he had his reasons, and he itemized them on the NBC program Meet the Press yesterday.
Senator Obama has captured the feelings of the young people of America and is reaching out in a more diverse, inclusive way across our society.
That's Barack Obama yesterday on Meet the Press. He's one of the most trusted Americans, but he certainly had some difficulties in the Bush administration, especially in his arguments for presenting a rationale to the world for the Iraq war. What does it mean, this endorsement? And what do endorsements in general mean for a campaign at this stage? William Luchtenberg is a presidential historian from University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He joins us now on the line from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. William Luchtenberg, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
You know, this is a big headline for the Barack Obama campaign, but I'm wondering if you get down into the details, does it translate into votes? And if so, where?
Well, I think most of the commentary so far has concentrated on the boost that this gives to the legitimacy of the Obama campaign. I think probably a more important point is that it raises serious questions about the legitimacy of the McCain-Palin ticket.
You know,
for the most part, endorsements don't switch voters to a different position. But this is more like the 1964 situation, where numbers of prominent Republicans said that Goldwater was unacceptable.
That's interesting. You know, the great irony here is that, you know, originally in this campaign, it was all about Barack Obama's experience and judgment. And now Colin Powell has teed up the debate that, no, in fact, it's John McCain and Sarah Palin's judgment that's at question. And, you know, the issue for McCain has always been, I'm not Bush, I'm not Bush. And here's Bush's Secretary of State endorsing Obama, and it looks like Obama is distancing himself from George W. Bush. It's an amazing reversal on two levels.
That's absolutely right. And furthermore, General Powell said was that Obama could be a transformational figure, and we're beginning to hear talk about whether this election could mean a realignment. And that creates, even among Obama's more ardent followers, a sense of excitement that has not always been there, given the coolness of the persona that Obama presents to the country.
What do you make on this realignment question of the $150 million that the Obama campaign claims that it has raised in September? And I guess the number of contributors is something on the order of 640,000 new contributors, something like that. You know, does that suggest a realignment to you?
Well, I don't think in itself it suggests a realignment. It does suggest that we're in a new phase of American politics with respect to fundraising. I think the most important point about all of this, is, which has largely been overlooked, is the presumption has to be that most of the money is being contributed by reasonably well-to-do white voters. That is a phenomenon we've not seen before and has to be encouraging to the Obama campaign.
And William, what's your thought on how this endorsement actually translates into votes? How many voters, whether you're talking about moderate Republicans or independents, do you think his words will affect?
Well, that is a legitimate question, and at this point, has to be speculative. What I would think is most likely is not that this endorsement is going to move voters from the McCain camp to the Obama campaign, or even necessarily move independent voters to decide on the basis of this endorsement alone that they're going to support Obama, but rather that it's going to counteract the Bradley effect.
Interesting. And the Bradley effect, of course, being people who will not vote for an African-American but won't say so, and so therefore are invisible to pollsters. Really quickly, William, you're a presidential historian. You mentioned 64. Johnson was going to win that race no matter what. Is there an endorsement that ever was really decisive? We just have a few seconds.
Yeah, I think not, and one can see endorsements of that that appeared to make might make a lot of difference, like the powerful Union leader John L. Lewis supporting Wendell Willkie in 1940, breaking with the Democrats, and had no effect whatsoever.
No effect. Interesting. Well, William Luckenberg, it's great to talk to you. He's a presidential historian from UNC Chapel Hill and spoke with us from Chapel Hill. Thank you, William.
Right. Good to talk to you. Right. Bye.
Well, you haven't heard the word or the name Goldwater in a while, so he sort of injected some interesting elements. This morning, we have some stunning economic news out of China, not particularly good. The country's economy is slowing down. It grew at a rate of 9% in the most recent quarter. That's down 2 points. That may not sound like a lot, but it's underscoring worries that the spreading financial crisis threatens the world's fastest growing economy. We go to Shanghai now with BBC correspondent Quentin Somerville. Thanks for being with us, Quentin.
Hi there, Adora.
So tell us about this 9% growth.
Well, 9% might sound pretty good in America, but here in China, as you say, it's the lowest in 5 years. And actually, I'm standing in Shanghai on the historic Bund overlooking the Huangpu River. On the other side is Pudong, Shanghai's financial district, with the most incredible, outrageous skyscrapers you've ever seen. There are still skyscrapers being built over there, and the river is still full of ships, which are loaded with the raw materials which are powering this great economy. It still feels like an economy that's growing. But when I was down in the street earlier and speaking to ordinary Shanghainese people, they were telling me that they're feeling the pinch now. The stock market's down, house prices are down, and they know that many of the factories in China are seeing their export orders drying up. Half the toy factories in China closed in the last year, we heard from the government last week. So they really are beginning to feel the drop from, well, the economy was growing at 12% last year to 9% now. China hasn't escaped. It isn't immune from the global slowdown.
Quentin, it just seems rather sudden. 6 months ago, we were hearing about how China's growth was really driving the need for oil and impacting oil prices. Now, how do you explain this drop suddenly?
Well, the drop is because the American consumer, who placed all those orders in Chinese factories, just isn't ordering so much now. So those Chinese factories don't need to order so much oil, so much copper, so much iron ore and all the other things that went into television sets or DVD players and everything. And actually, the Chinese government saw this coming. Their great worry was that China's growth at 12%, and in fact, in some places in the country, 14 and 16%, wasn't sustainable. So they knew that the economy was going to have to slow down a bit. Now the problem, though, is making sure it doesn't slow down too much. Earlier last week, we saw that 7,000 toy workers down in the south lost their jobs overnight when the factory went bust. The government had to step in and pay them their wages because those workers didn't have any work. They were turning up outside the factory to protest. And if that starts happening across China, across China's industrial areas, then the government has trouble on its hands.
So how do you believe that this report is going to affect world markets?
Well, the big hope was that the Chinese consumer and consumers in the developing world would take over from the American consumer and the European consumer. China's middle class is strong. It's about 200 million strong now, and there are plenty of Ferraris and Porsches in Shanghai and in Beijing. But when you go out of these cities, this is still a country made up of peasant farmers and of migrant workers, and they have an income of about a 15th of Americans. So they aren't ready to take on the burden of the world economy when it comes to spending.
And so what do you expect the Chinese government may do given this news?
They're going to do what every other government does. There'll be interest rate cuts. They'll make it easier for businesses to borrow money, and they'll hope that that's enough to keep the economy powering along. The long-term hope is that China is less reliant on exports, that it doesn't have to rely on those American customers and those European customers, and actually that this economy grows and matures and becomes a continental economy, just like the United States and Europe. That's China's future, Chinese spenders rather than European and American spenders.
Quentin Somerville, thanks for joining us. Quentin Somerville is a BBC correspondent. He was based in Shanghai. 1/15 consumers in China have versus Americans.
There's a lot of things happening on our website, principally among them. Many of you are contacting us with suggestions for the kinds of things we should do on the program. We want to keep those suggestions coming. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've already done two, and they've been really, really great. Here's also a report from America's Exit Poll.
My name is Sue, and I'm calling from Ohio. I decided who to vote for when I heard the Joe the Plumber story. I'm definitely going to vote for Barack Obama.
Man, America's exit poll does not look good for John McCain. If you voted as an early voter, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us your story or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We learned this morning that a high-profile endorsement did not help Wendell Willkie in his presidential battle against Harry Truman. But will Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack Obama help his campaign? Do endorsements matter to you as a voter?
Boy, John, you went all the way down back to Willkie?
Luchtenberg did, our professor at the top of the hour.
Yeah,
anyway, we're asking
what
you think of the Barack Obama endorsement at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And now we're going to continue to take a look at key Senate races across the country. Today we go to Georgia, where not long ago Republican incumbent Saxby Chambliss looked like a shoo-in. But a combination of major gas shortages last month, the state's growing unemployment rate, and overall economic woes have given his Democratic challenger, Jim Martin, a boost. Professor William Boone from the Political Science Department at Clark Atlanta University joins us with more. Welcome back, Professor.
Good morning. Thank you.
How tight is the race?
It is very tight. Martin is pulled within maybe a couple points, give or take, the margin of error.
So do you think it's singularly the economy, or are there other issues that have helped propel Martin?
I think, it's the economy overall, and, of course, the economy in Georgia is very, very tight right now. The state is now at a point where the governor is asking state agencies to take a severe cut in their budget. And then couple that with the fact that over the last couple of months, major employers, at least in the metropolitan area of Atlanta, have closed down. General Motors, Ford, all these have closed. And then you look at the fact that over 6.3 or 6.2% unemployment rate in the state, which surpasses the national rate. So that's it. And of course, the idea that the Republicans have not exactly done as well as they thought. They're squabbling among themselves, as happens in these states when the out party becomes the in party.
And Martin has certainly gotten some help from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Did that come in at a late hour when it started to look as if he could really give Chambliss a run for his money?
Yeah, that's come very late. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting that Martin is even to some extent is not altogether sort of trying to distance himself even from that, because the campaigns from the Senate, from the Democratic Senate campaign committee, have centered on the fact that Chambliss is supportive of this national sales tax. And that's just one more idea about the whole economy thing. And the way that they portray that is that it actually becomes a raise in taxes for the middle class.
Let's listen to one of his ads, actually, about the fair tax as he attacks Jim Martin.
Jim Martin's not telling the truth about the fair tax. The fair tax does not raise taxes. It actually abolishes income tax, corporate income tax, capital gains tax, payroll tax, self-employment tax, and estate and gift tax. And the fair tax will completely abolish the IRS. Saxby Chambliss has never supported a tax increase, but Jim Martin...
And, Professor, this is an interesting tact, because it's really a local discussion about a federal issue where there is no national discussion about a national sales tax.
That's correct. It's very interesting. It is. And as a matter of fact, it's so interesting that, as I said earlier, Martin is not exactly all that gung-ho behind it himself. In fact, Martin simply goes back to the old idea that we're talking Georgia politics and that national politics, and he begins to zero in on the whole question of the fact that Saxby Chambliss has been very supportive of the programs of the Bush administration, and those programs have been devastating to Georgia's economy.
And we have a bit of one of Jim Martin's ads, too. Let's listen.
We get a recession and a Wall Street meltdown. Saxby Chambliss gets an A-plus in George Bush economics.
I'm Jim Martin, and I approve this message because we need to wipe the slate clean in Washington.
Now, that's obviously a tack that many Democrats are taking across the country. Let me ask you this specific to Chambliss, which is he is known as a fierce competitor. He beat Max Cleland, who was the sitting senator at the time, a Vietnam vet, a triple amputee, by painting him as unpatriotic in what many described as dirty campaigning. What's his strategy been against Martin?
It's also been somewhat negative, maybe not quite as badly as he portrayed Cleveland, but certainly he is beginning to shade some of the truth, I would suggest, as it related to Martin's previous job as director of the state's welfare department when some children unfortunately died. And he's come off strong on that and simply saying that you can't trust Martin because he did a poor job and that children died on his watch, certainly leaving the impression that Martin was responsible for the deaths of the children. And it comes very close to that. And he's beginning to hit even harder because as the campaign tightens and he feels Martin breathing down his neck, he's really strapped up his attack on how Martin is a failed politician. And this comes very interesting, too, because you think about the fact that these guys are fraternity brothers out of the University of Georgia.
Did they know each other in school?
Yes, they did. Chambliss, as I understand it, was a bit ahead of Martin, but they still knew each other.
William Boone, Professor, thank you for that snapshot. He always says, as you, John, he always brings a little detail or two that we didn't know. William Boone, Professor of Political Science at Clark Atlanta University. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some headlines for us.
Thank you very much, Dora. Major indices in Europe are all up a bit. That comes amid news that the Dutch government will invest $13.4 billion in the banking giant ING. Also in Europe, the chief executive of a major French bank is done. The CEO of Caisse d'Epargne resigned, saying he's taking full responsibility for the $800 million loss the bank posted last week. The party of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is holding off on an agreement to keep US forces in Iraq for another 3 years. The ruling Shiite coalition says that they want to revise a draft outlining terms for the American presence there. The former president of Botswana has won one of the world's most valuable political awards, the Mo Ibrahim Prize for Excellence in African Leadership. Kofi Annan announced the award this morning.
The committee is delighted to announce Festus Mongai as the worthy winner of this year's Ibrahim Prize for Achievement in African Leadership. Actually, it should be simply achievement in leadership. Leadership is leadership, African or elsewhere. And he's been an outstanding leader.
And the prize was originally designed to encourage African leaders to step down from office and become worthy elder statesmen. Mr. Mongai will receive $5 million over the next 10 years, plus a further $200,000 a year for life. Mr. Mongai stepped down as president in April after 10 years in office. And this award is really interesting because it's one of those ideas that was an African solution for an African problem.
Although it's a little bit like
bribing.
Well, the award is we're paying you to go away.
Yes. Yeah. but statesmanlike.
Statesmanlike, go away.
Do you think that might work in Zimbabwe?
Well, I don't know. It's probably as likely as the CEO of Caisse d'Epargne actually repaying the $800 million that the loss it reported. Thanks, Pam.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In the mid-1960s, some white clergymen in Omaha, Nebraska, wanted to open a dialogue about race relations in their community. And when they began to ask blacks in Omaha what they thought of racial segregation, and especially what it would mean to them if white ministers in their community openly called for integration, well, they got an earful.
You couldn't walk around and talk to people, stand up in your pulpit on Sunday and preach nice little songs and say, now we're going to give thanks to the Lord for he is good and old Jesus be among us. As far as we're concerned, your Jesus is contaminated, just like everything else you tried to force upon us is contaminated.
That's the voice of a young black barber named Ernie Chambers, whose candor and eloquence is just one of the powerful voices in the documentary A Time for Burning. The film documented a local community's attempts to deal with racial tension more than 40 years ago. That young barber is with us. He's also a former Nebraska state senator, the longest serving in the state's history. Ernie Chambers, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here. I'm older, grayer, wiser, and meaner, and I'll be a state senator until January of next year.
All right. Very well said. Also joining us is the man who documented the struggle, filmmaker Bill Jersey. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, John.
Now, we're here with both of you because the film is being screened here in New York. It's going to be broadcast on the documentary channel, the cable channel, and it represents a really fascinating window into a time of history that we associate with the big marches on Washington, but maybe not so much the smaller efforts that were taking place in communities like Omaha and Nebraska. Bill, how did you come to think that this community would be a film? And it was nominated for an Academy Award at the time.
For the reason you said. I didn't want to do a film about the South. That was made all my northern friends feel very pious and not like them. I didn't even want to do a film on the city, which say, well, that's the city problems and so forth. I wanted to do a film on Middle America. And so but I was asked to do the film by the church, as you know. And so we had to find a church that was going to be active in race relations. And incidentally, very importantly, I asked the church, what is it you want me to do with the church? They said, we want the church's response to racial tension. I said, that's good, because I'm not going to do a film about the church's answer to racial tension.
So, Ernie, describe to me, and I want to play some more of what you said in the film, A Time for Burning, but describe to me what it was like when these white clergymen came to you and some of your colleagues and friends and said, hey, we're really concerned about racial tensions, you know, we'd like to talk.
Well, only one came to me, and that was Reverend Youngdahl,
right.
And I told him that Omaha is so bad that as mild as this thing is that you're talking about, which was to have people from the respective congregations visit each other in their homes, not the churches.
Right.
I said, they'll kick you out of your church. And
now,
that's what happened to him.
That is what happened to him. We'll talk about that in a moment. But here's one of the things you told Reverend Youngdahl.
You're treaty breakers, you're liars, you're thieves, you rape entire continents and races of people. Then you wonder why these very people don't have any confidence or trust in you. Your religion means nothing. Your law is a farce, and we see it every day. You demonstrated it in Alabama. And I can say you because you're part of the whole system. You profit from it. In fact, you make your living from it.
Ernie, I have to say there's not a single edit in that sound. I mean, you just rattled that off the top of your head right there. First of all, were you telling Reverend Youngdahl to go away, get lost, I don't want to talk to you?
I was just having a conversation with him. If he was strong enough to dialogue with me, we would have talked as long as he chose.
Mm-hmm.
But when I talk to somebody, I'm going to say what I think and believe, not necessarily what that person wants to hear.
Do you still believe that today?
Absolutely.
Really?
That's why they got term limits in Nebraska, to get me out of the legislature. And they said that was why.
Well, I mean, a lot of people would think, and I think a lot of people listening to this program would think, that talking about race relations would actually be a good thing. In your experience, it actually didn't turn out so well, at least if this film is any indication.
As a student of history, I read the interrelationship between white Americans and the government and the Native Americans. And whenever the Native Americans talked to the white people, they wound up losing their land and on a reservation. So I never talked to white people with my guard down. I'm as nice to people as they are to me, but I never believe that they're here with absolutely good intentions.
What compromises did you make in the legislature in Nebraska when you became part of the power structure and actually had to sit down with people and work out problems?
I didn't have to compromise. They came my direction, and when I first got there are a lot of efforts I put forth that were not successful, but they saw that I don't shoot blanks, I don't blow smoke, I mastered the rules, and even the newspapers described me as the single most powerful politician in the state.
Bill
it's
Jersey,
just honesty.
Bill Jersey, it's so sad to see how much Ernie has changed over the past 40 years, how really it softened him completely. But did you have any idea that this character who was, you know, you first met in a barbershop, it seemed, with your camera, would go on to become an influential legislator in Nebraska? you?
No, I didn't. In fact, he told me he wasn't going to. In one of my last conversations with Ernie in Omaha, I said, Ernie, with your capacity for rhetoric, your gift for language, and your intellect and understanding of things as they are, you absolutely must be in government. It's where you can make the most positive contribution. And he said, I would never go into government. You go into government, you have to be fake. So you see, that was the one time Ernie was wrong. But he wasn't wrong because he didn't mean himself. He meant in general.
Right. Well, and the Reverend Youngdahl, who began this initiative, was ousted from his church. What's happened to those clergymen over the years, Bill?
Well, I don't know what's happened to those collectively, but I know Bill Youngdahl made a very wise decision. He went from Omaha to Berkeley.
Big
There's
difference.
A change. There's yeah. a change. So what is the lesson of this film, A Time for Burning, you think, for people who would see it today as opposed to in the mid-60s when all of this was... It's amazing how well it holds up, it seems to me.
Well, I think it's a green film because it deals with what I call the big T, not the little T. The big T is the fundamental truth that exists in any situation or in any relationship. The little T are the facts about it. So the facts about this film are that there's a minister who has no name. Well, he's named in the film verbally, but you know there's no lower thirds in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's why one of the networks didn't want to air it, because they said, how do I know who these people are? And I said, you listen, you watch, you'll know who they are. But anyhow... Sorry, are we...
We're getting close to the end of the segment, but I want to ask Ernie before we go, what do you think the lessons of this film are?
Racism is of the warp and woof of Americana, and since racism doesn't change, America doesn't change, what was said 40 years ago is as true today as it was then, but things have become worse. Scruffy Jim Crow has now become polished, urbane James Crow Esquire.
Even with Barack Obama... running for president?
White people like Barack Obama. They don't like black people.
Whoa. Ernie Chambers, he has not lost. No bullets. No blanks. Only bullets from Ernie Chambers.
I got to throw in just one line
quickly,
if I can.
Yeah.
The one line quickly is that this film is not, as I said, it's not about Omaha or church. So what this film is about is that in the presence of one's fear, one can take action that can make a difference.
Action, candor, and a frank discussion of race relations is what A Time for Burning is all about. I want to thank both of you. Bill Jersey, filmmaker of A Time for Burning, and Ernie Chambers, who was featured in that mill. You want to say one last thing?
I want to say, where is the show tonight? So if somebody hears this and wants to come tonight.
Oh, where is the show tonight?
It's Lighthouse
Theater.
The Lighthouse Theater. It's being put on by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
That's right, and it'll be broadcast on the documentary channel. Thank you, Bill Jersey, and thank you,
John.
Ernie Chambers.
Thank you.
A Time for Burning.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Continuing with our history lesson, the mid-70s were a trying time for America's sense of itself. The economy was bad. Our power was suspect at the end of the Vietnam War.
It's about 8:10 this morning. What looked like a final Marine helicopter touched down here briefly, took aboard a handful of Marines, and then lifted off. And that looked like the end of the American evacuation.
1975, and this Vietnam syndrome persisted into the Reagan 1980s. And there was, of course, the demoralizing Iranian hostage crisis in 1979. The economy was still in trouble as late as 1983, and then on October 23rd of that year, America's impotence and weakness seemed to hit bottom in a bloody, devastating attack in Beirut, Lebanon.
The truck bomb attack in the fall of 1983 killed 241 Marines. Not so many Americans had died since the Vietnam War.
And those Marines weren't even in combat. They were just there to keep the Israelis and PLO fighters away from each other. American morale seemed to take a massive hit. In the midst of this crisis, it was hard to see what the path was to restore U.S. credibility in the world. But 2 days after the Marine bombing, the Reagan administration had an announcement.
Early this morning, forces from 6 Caribbean democracies and the United States began a landing or landings on the island of Grenada in the Eastern Caribbean.
An invasion of the smallest independent country in the Western Hemisphere? Operation Urgent Fury, it was called. Was this some kind of sideshow? Not at all. Grenada, the president said, was the front line in the Cold War.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy. We got there just in time.
Just in time to protect American lives, the president said. Among the Americans were medical students studying in Grenada because there weren't places for them in American medical schools. It was the first major operation conducted by the U.S. military since the Vietnam War and had the lopsided outcome of a training exercise. But that didn't stop Ian Jacobs, Grenada's deputy U.N. ambassador, the day after the U.S. invaded, to warn of a new domino theory of advancing communism.
We need to all ask ourselves, if we allow this to happen to Grenada, what stops it from happening to any one of us here? Because none of us, not one of us, is equivalent in size or power to the United States.
There was criticism of this as bullying smaller nations. But when the UN condemned the invasion of Grenada as akin to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, President Reagan proudly exclaimed his disgust.
Helen, 100 nations in the United Nations have not agreed with us on just about everything that's come before them where we're involved. And you know, it didn't upset my breakfast at all.
With this attitude, President Reagan won a second term in 1984 in a landslide. The economy was starting to turn around. Something seemed to be shifting. It may have been hard to see at the time, but this 1983 event was a turning point for American foreign policy, a theme carried forward even to our day. Today, neither the Marine bombing nor the Grenada invasion seemed to stick in the memory of most Americans. In the 1997 movie Wag the Dog, Robert De Niro's character convinces Dustin Hoffman's character that Grenada was just a cover for the Marine bombing 2 days earlier. Change the headline, change the story, it said in the movie. Americans don't remember the wars. In the movies, they only remember the slogans.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
You know, on this show, sometimes I think I should just not even open my mouth.
This is Henry Parson from Farley, New Jersey. I just wanted to mention that Wilkie ran against Roosevelt, not against Truman.
Lots of presidential historians out there. You're right. Wilkie ran against FDR, not Truman. I mentioned him after our conversation with William Luchtenberg about whether anyone's endorsement, Colin Powell's being the principal suggestion this morning, has ever been decisive. Thanks for that. Call us anytime, whether I'm wrong or right.
Or I'm wrong or right.
That'll be a lot of calls.
He's going to get, I think
it's
going to be
now.
A fight.
There's
going to be a fight
now.
In the parking lot after.
So in trouble.
We're going to move on to you, Femi, okay.
Mummy, Udoji is going to be on the phone now. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. It's been nice knowing you, John.
Yeah.
Good morning. Share prices have risen in Asia and Europe following the latest moves to strengthen banks and the international financial system. Asia markets saw solid gains after South Korea announced a major rescue package providing $130 billion to help banks and financial institutions. China has experienced its lowest rate of growth for 5 years, with exports being hurt by the global credit crunch. In the 3 months up to September, the annual growth rate slowed to 9%, which is lower than predictions. Zimbabwe's opposition and ruling party are not talking to each other. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai and President Robert Mugabe still haven't made an agreement on cabinet posts. Mediator and former South African President Thabo Mbeki will be in Swaziland today to report to Southern African leaders, and a meeting will try to break the deadlock over the formation of a power-sharing government in Zimbabwe. In Turkey, a right-wing group is charged with provoking chaos in an attempt to overthrow the ruling party. The trial, which started today, is chaotic in its own right. Officials had trouble trying to seat all 86 defendants and the lawyers in the same room, and hundreds of people demonstrated outside. And finally, tributes are coming in for Dee Dee Warwick. She's a soul singer who sang the hits before they became really big hits. Dee Dee Warwick died on Saturday in New Jersey, and she was the younger sister of Dionne Warwick, and they sang together. And Dee Dee also recorded the original versions of R&B hits like I'm Gonna Make You Love Me and You're No Good, Foolish Fool. Most recently this year, she sang in her sister's autobiographical tour and also on the album that was out earlier this year called Why We Sing with Dionne Warwick. So that's Dee Dee Warwick. She died in New Jersey at 63 years old this weekend.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
I'm going to turn now to a much more serious note. Since 9/11 here in the United States, terrorism rose quickly to the top of things that Americans fear most. But new research, according to one analyst, shows the current financial crisis has trumped terrorism. William Burns, a research scientist at Decision Research Think Tank, joins us now to explain. Welcome, William.
Yes, good morning. Glad to be here.
Now, it's not terribly surprising, given the fact that people are worrying about keeping their homes, they're worrying about putting gas in their gas tanks, that that would become the number one concern as opposed to something that could potentially happen.
Yeah, that's right. What we do with Decision Research is actually look at how people respond to all manner of threats. Decision Research has been a pioneer in that area for about 30 years. And about 3.5 weeks ago, it all of a sudden dawned on us that we had a unique opportunity to actually look at, study public risk perception and risk-related behaviors in the midst of an ongoing economic crisis. And I and my colleagues there sort of worked feverishly for a few-day period to develop a online survey with a panel that we have put together nationwide over the last several months. And we launched, our goal was to actually launch this survey nationwide on the morning of Monday, September 29th, never realizing that the timing couldn't have been
better. Oh, my goodness.
Better. You know, the largest drop in the stock market in U.S. history. And so what we plan to do, to address some of the questions you just raised, is to actually follow a group of people, about 800 people nationwide, through this financial crisis.
Oh, so you're still following them now?
Say it again.
You're still following those 800 people
Absolutely.
Now?
We plan to do at least 6 surveys. We've done 2 already.
And what have you learned?
What have we learned so far? Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of anger with regard to how the economy has been managed. There's a lot of fear, as you mentioned at the introduction to the broadcast. There is a lot of concerns about what their future holds. There's a lot of very, very negative feelings about Wall Street. We asked the question, what's your first image that comes to mind when you think about Wall Street? And it was extraordinarily negative, crash, dishonest, corruption. And this is a very serious sign because if Wall Street were to become stigmatized in people's minds, mm-hmm. particularly the average investor, they may be very, very reluctant to then put their money back in the stock market, even when the market begins to turn around.
Because nothing affects our actions, right, like fear.
Fear is a big motivator for our actions. And what we know from probably 30 years of work in this area is that when people are afraid, their perceptions of risk begin to go up. They begin to take less risk. They pull back. And in the investment community, this might mean that we've seen that people are putting their money. There's a flight to cash, for example, which makes a lot of sense right now. But how long will people do this? Because there's opportunity costs for operating on fear. Investors are very, very afraid right now, as measured by some of the indicators like the VIX index that measures 30-day expectations for volatility in the stock market. This is at sky-high levels. So this the fears that investors have correspond with the kind of fear that we're seeing in the in our surveys. And the other thing we found, and this is something that will have to be dealt with, is there's a profound lack of trust. We asked our
you mean more so than at other times in our history, or more so, what are you comparing it to?
Well, I think it is more. If you look at the last, say, 8 years of President Bush's administration, I think there's been, for a variety of reasons, an erosion of trust. And so when we asked our respondents, to what degree do you trust President Bush, the Congress, business leaders, mm-hmm. and so forth, here's how it went. Business leaders, when we asked to what degree do you feel that business leaders can help with the economic challenges we're facing, only 3% said they had high or very high trust. Congress, only 4% of our respondents said high or very high trust. The Secretary of the Treasury, 4%. President Bush was at 3%. John McCain was up at 12%. Barack Obama at about 22%.
So does that, so, that was going to be my next question. How do we extrapolate this into, I hate to use the word predicting behavior, but does it help explain what some of the polls have been showing, Barack Obama pulling ahead of John McCain?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at right after the Republican convention, where Sarah Palin was in the news quite a bit, the polling results began to turn in Senator McCain's favor. As soon as we entered into the financial crisis, you began to see this come around, and I think that is for a couple of reasons. One, Barack Obama has put forth, I think, a very consistent message of change. And I also think on the trust issue, Barack Obama has not only been maybe a clear message on the financial challenges, but he's a very, very calm, even-minded, almost unflappable type of communicator. And I think the American public has responded very well to that.
William Burns, thank you for your snapshot today.
Glad to do it.
William Burns, a research scientist at Decision Research.
We are always on at thetakeaway.org, where you can express your fears on any subject. You can join the conversation online, and if you missed anything, catch up with us on iTunes.
Today we're talking about the Colin Powell endorsement of Barack Obama for president. Has anyone's endorsement, or any endorsement, whether it be a newspaper, ever made a difference in how you voted? I'd like to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway for this hour.
It's going to counteract the Bradley effect.
That's William Luchtenberg, presidential historian from UNC Chapel Hill, talking about Colin Powell's endorsement and saying that, in fact, it probably is going to have no effect if history is any guide.
Well, that's what's so interesting. There's so many new developments, whether you're talking about the economy or you're talking about this presidential election. It's uncharted waters. We haven't been here before. And so a lot of folks aren't sure what to make of any of it.
Well, I would say follow the money. The $150 million raised in September is probably a bigger story than Colin Powell. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And that's your takeaway. John Hockenberry says follow the money.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Good morning, Vicki Rovere.
Morning.
Good morning. We couldn't help but be struck by your email that you sent to us last week. It was really great. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Well, you asked everyone what would happen if Americans rallied together to help the economy. It's something like if we agreed to levels of sacrifice and cooperation like during World War II. I mean, do you really think that's possible?
It would be a big change. Let's see.
Well, you called for a national money pool put up by ordinary consumers to lend to businesses and to bolster the stock market, that sort of thing. So we'd all give money into the pool interest-free, is that right?
Well, locally for local businesses, but right, uh-huh. interest-free.
Yeah. How much are you good for, Vicki?
I could scrape together $100.
$100?
Mm-hmm.
How about 200?
I live very simply.
Well, 100 times 200 million equals 20 billion. That could sure help, Vicki.
Then people who had more could give more.
Turning drops in the bucket into a Niagara, a patriotic economy. Can it work? We'll find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 20th. And John, we've brought in noted economist Dr. Jeffrey Sachs to answer Vicki's questions.
I think Vicki was trying to get me to contribute to the fund there at the end. Good morning, Adora.
I think she was, too. Yeah. We'll see about that. Today, the latest on the presidential campaign with just over 2 weeks left. Also, after the markets took a wild ride, what can we expect this week? And a look at the Supreme Court the next president will inherit and likely significantly change. Those stories coming up first, these headlines.
An endorsement for Barack Obama, and here's his reaction.
I have been honored to have the benefit of his wisdom and his counsel from time to time over the last few years. But today I'm beyond honored. I am deeply humbled to have the support of General Colin Powell.
The endorsement comes with a report from the Obama campaign that it raised a record $150 million in September. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke testifies on the Hill today. As always, traders will be listening for any hints of future Fed interest rate cuts.
World markets are trending up this hour. Major Asian indexes closed higher. European indexes are almost rising. Almost all of them are rising based on the trading in futures markets. The Dow will be up when markets open in a few minutes. Among news boosting the markets this morning, the Dutch government's move to prop up banking giant ING. The Netherlands will invest $13.4 billion in the company.
Ground ball to second. Iwamoto's got it. Rays are going to the World Series.
Not the Red Sox. The Tampa Bay Rays are going to the World Series. They finished off the Boston Red Sox last night to advance. It's a strange feeling for the Rays, who spent most of the last decade dead last in their division. The Rays now take on the Philadelphia Phillies. Game one of the World Series starts on Wednesday. We're asking you your opinion of the Colin Powell endorsement of the Barack Obama campaign, and here's your answer.
How could anyone take Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack Obama seriously? In light of the fact that he sold a bill of goods to the world that turned out to be a tragic mistake.
The political implications of endorsements coming up on the program. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Has an endorsement ever mattered to you, a person, or a newspaper editorial? My Take at thetakeaway.org. Register your story.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. If the race to the White House for Barack Obama was a business model rather than a presidential campaign, you might say he'd already be CEO and chairman of the board. He raised $66 million in August and more than doubled it in September, $150 million in the war chest of the Barack Obama campaign. Oh, and Colin Powell endorsed him over the weekend. Yes, it's just another manic Monday for the Barack Obama campaign. And here to talk about this is New York Times reporter Jeff Zeleny. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Let's talk about the money. At this stage in the campaign, to have this kind of a trend line up and these sorts of numbers of people who are actually contributing, there has to be some broad political significance, even outside of the financial significance of this, right?
Well, I think you're right. It probably means at least one thing, that these people will vote. If they're spending money, if they're investing themselves into a presidential campaign, a lot of whom are doing so for the first time, it almost certainly means that in 15 days they will probably vote, and I would think vote for Senator Obama since they're giving him money.
Now, there's a raw, you know, you're way out on a limb there, Jeff. Do you have any raw numbers on how many people contributed?
Well, in the month of September alone, there were 632,000 new contributors. So far during the Obama campaign, you know, during almost the last 20 months or so, there are 3.1 million contributors. So what this means is the average contribution was some $86. Of course, you know, most of the money coming in was through large fundraisers. Senator Obama has really had an aggressive schedule, hosting fundraisers from Los Angeles to Miami to a New York City, in big cities, small cities, doing very high-ticket, high-dollar fundraisers. But the average contribution comes down because of a lot of people. A lot of these new contributors are just, you know, sending in $5, $10, $20. So the average contribution is $86 in the month of September. And we think they will also raise a lot in October. So what this gives them is just a major financial advantage against Senator McCain. And they can spend money wherever they want in the next 2 weeks.
Really quickly, before we go, is there any way to break out the electoral significance of these large numbers of contributors? I mean, are they all in New York or California? Or are they more broadly distributed?
The contributors are coming from all over the country. A lot of them are coming from so-called blue states, if you will, so it's not necessarily helpful electorally because he'll win those places anyway. But we have done a breakdown of contributions in the past for the Obama campaign, and they do come from all across the country, but primarily urban areas, primarily places where he's doing well anyway.
Jeff Zeleny, thank you very much. New York Times reporter Jeff Zeleny reporting on the Barack Obama campaign. There was the other big news over the weekend, and that, of course, was Colin Powell endorsing Barack Obama. Have endorsements ever changed your mind? Have they ever mattered to you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
And, of course, John, one of the key issues in the campaign is this economic turmoil we've been experiencing for the past weeks and months. And we begin today, this week, after a series of severe ups and downs on the markets last week. There were lots of gloomy news reports, but Jim Ellis, assistant managing editor of Business Week, argues, though there are still tough times ahead, no doubt, there might be some clues that the market might be heading toward calmer waters. Jim joins us here in the studio this morning. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Adar.
So let's start, though, first with Fed Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. He's expected to testify today on Capitol Hill. What are we likely to hear from him?
We're likely to hear from him that, you know, he's starting to see some thawing in the credit markets, which is really important. I mean, that he spent a lot of time and effort and a lot of our taxpayers' money basically pumping money into the financial system, increasing liquidity, and he needs to be able to go out and say now it's starting to work. We've seen a couple of signs. Last week we saw LIBOR, that London Interbank Offered Rate, which is basically the rate that banks charge one another for overnight or short-term loans in London in dollars. That's actually come down about a half point last week, and it's actually in the futures market, at least today, it's coming down again, and it won't be announced until midday today. It means that basically we're starting to see a little thawing.
Which, of course, would be good news, and hopes that it would continue this week.
It's definitely good news for the banking system.
It
would take a little longer before we see how it comes down to normal people.
But the mortgage rates are spiking, I hear, over the weekend. One of the consequences of this bailout is that mortgage rates are starting to creep up.
This is one of the big problems, which is, do you save the banking system? Do you save the consumer? Unfortunately, you have to save the banking system before you can save the consumer. And so what's going to happen is that consumers, things like mortgage rates, things like availability of car loans, things like just credit card debt, that's going to have to wait a little bit until banks feel more comfortable in lending.
But let's look at what the markets did, which you say at this point it's become so irrational that you would suspect that the bottom is near. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, we've had really wild volatility. It's not just the numbers we've seen in some days. You know, last week we had one day where the market was down over 900 points. We also was down over 500 points. It was one day was up over 900 points. It was a little crazy. And some of the intraday periods were actually up to 1,000-point spread in a single day. That sort of means that people didn't quite know how to price assets. Now, what that means is that there's not enough information out in the marketplace. But when we've seen this big a drop, where we've seen stocks basically fall about 40% since last October, and we're starting to see the economy, you know, starting to bottom out, then it probably means we've gotten to the point where rational behavior has stopped, where panic has set in, and that usually signals a bottom. I mean, we last week had stocks selling for less than the value of cash on their balance sheets. In other words, you could have bought them and paid for your purchase with their own cash. That's completely irrational from an economic standpoint, and that's a pretty good sign that we're getting near the bottom because people have stopped looking at any fundamentals.
But there is this problem. Consumers have a fundamental mistrust of what's going on. There's indications today that the number of people has gone from 28 in September percent to 15% of those who believe the country is moving in the right direction. So in other words, at this point, 85% of Americans are thinking that the country's not moving in the right direction. Two-thirds of our economy is based on consumer spending. The banking bailout does go towards steadying the banking industry. However, it doesn't necessarily put more money in people's pockets so that they can go out and start spending.
In time for Christmas.
So where's that step, right? I mean, mortgages are about to be reset. There are many in the next 2 years that will be reset. Well, how are people going to be able to pay those things?
Well, that step comes supposedly next. I mean, the problem in a market economy, particularly a market economy like ours that's based on finance, is that the financial system has to stay solvent and continue to run for average people to take advantage of it. In other words, finance is sort of the thing that keeps the whole business of the machine of the American economy moving. It's like the grease there. When it stops, all of a sudden the machinery parts stop. People can't borrow to make payroll. People can't hire new workers. People can't, people lose their jobs. And so what Bernanke has decided is we've got to prop up banks, and that has to take precedent over everyone else. Once banks are propped up and feel comfortable lend again, then they can stop cutting home equity loan rates, which is or home equity loan lines, which is what they've been doing. They can hopefully do more in credit card lending, and that's at least the way it's supposed to work.
The hopefully part is the thing that worries me. I mean, there's nothing that compels the bank to feel more comfortable about lending. That's going to be a decision that they make on their own. The second part of it is that Bernanke says that the stock market is a leading indicator of the economy. So if the stock market hits bottom today, the Main Street economy will probably hit bottom some period out.
Right.
Any idea how much the stock market is leading the economy at this point?
The stock
and
market.
I'm almost afraid to hear your answer, actually.
The stock market typically leads about 6 months ahead of where the economy turns. I mean, that's over history. That's the way it's normally thought of. And so if the stock market bottoms out now, we won't expect an economic upturn or an economic bottom probably until end of Q1. Next year.
Quarter one next year.
Quarter one.
And so between now and then, you'd expect to see unemployment rise a little bit
right.
or a lot. What's your
estimation?
You're
going to see unemployment rise. I mean, typically unemployment rises about 3 points in a recession or from the trough to the peak. And in this case, we've already gotten about halfway there. So we're probably going to end up with another point and a half, point and a quarter on unemployment. And more importantly, though, we've had a tremendous, evaporation of consumer wealth in this country. I mean, basically, because of the drop in stocks, the drop in 401k plans, and the drop in housing, we've lost about $6.5, $7 trillion in American household wealth in just since the beginning of the year.
$7 trillion, that's a big number. Jim Ellis, we're going to have to stop you there, but will you stay around with us for the next hour? We're glad to have you. Jim Ellis is Assistant Managing Editor at Business Week. $7 trillion, John.
That's a lot.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, we're going to talk about the significance of Supreme Court nominations for the next president. But you can weigh in on all such issues at vote2008.thetakeaway.org and take part in a new poll to tell us what issues matter to you. We're talking about Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack Obama over the weekend. Jen on our website writes, "I don't know what Powell was waiting for. I think his endorsement would have been helpful if it had come out before the foreign policy debate. Now, not so much. But I do think that endorsements that cross party lines add to a comfort level for those voting for an unknown." What do you think? Do you agree with Jen? Has anyone's endorsement ever made a difference in how you voted? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Adora?
We've talked a lot about how important the economy is going to be or is in this election, but so is the Supreme Court. Whoever becomes president is going to be in a position to significantly change the dynamics of the Supreme Court because there are several justices who are likely to retire in the next 4 years. Professor Michael Dwarf is a constitutional law professor at Cornell Law School and a former clerk for Justice Anthony Kennedy. That would be a Supreme Court Justice, Anthony Kennedy. He joins us now with his thoughts. Professor, the issue of the Supreme Court didn't even come up until the final presidential debate. Why do you think this issue took so long to come up as part of the national discussion?
Well, I think neither party has a very strong interest in focusing voters on the Supreme Court. It's a good way to appeal to your base. For Democrats, that means people who are pro-choice, often against the death penalty, have views, strong views about habeas corpus and the excesses of the Bush administration. For Republicans, that means social conservatives who are going to be pro-life, who are going to be anti-gay, pro-death penalty. But if you look at sort of voters in the middle, they will tend to be to the center of either candidate's preferred choices. And so during a general election, when candidates are not speaking to their base, they really don't want to talk much about the Supreme Court, except in ways that reassure swing voters. In addition to that, swing voters, especially in tough economic times, are not very focused on the Supreme Court.
Let's take a look at what John McCain said during the debate last Wednesday about how he views how nominees should be picked.
I'm a Federalist, and I believe strongly that we should have nominees to the United States Supreme Court based on their qualifications rather than any litmus test.
I think you could make a strong argument that there he was certainly talking to his base. Professor, what does that mean in terms of the kind of nominees he's most likely to put forth if he becomes president?
Well, let's take those phrases one at a time. I'm a Federalist. Is a reference to the distribution of power between the state and federal governments. It's been an article of faith for social conservatives for a long time that the Supreme Court has taken away from the states the power to make decisions on issues such as abortion, gay rights, including same-sex marriage, the death penalty, and so forth. So that means, I think, that he wants justices who are going to roll back those rights. When he says that he doesn't want to apply a litmus test, that's a way of trying to soft pedal that view, but it's pretty clear that if he's answering that he's a Federalist on this point, that he thinks this is highly relevant to the decision. The middle sentence is a little perplexing. He says that judges should be judged on their qualifications. Well, everybody thinks that you should appoint highly qualified judges. The question is what kind of highly qualified judges. As a senator, I think John McCain's view has been, well, you give the president some leeway, but the question then is, what would he do as president? Once you have a pool of highly qualified candidates, how do you select from among that pool? And I think there's a pretty clear answer in there that he's going to do what Republican presidents have done over the course of the last generation, which is to look for pretty strongly committed conservatives.
Which is very different than Obama than Barack Obama and what he would do in his administration. Let's quickly listen to what he said.
It is true that this is going to be, I think, one of the most consequential decisions of the next president. It is very likely that one of us will be making at least one and probably more than one appointments, and Roe versus Wade probably hangs in the balance.
So he's talking about quickly give us the judges that could retire in the next 4 years and then just quickly describe the kind of nominees you'd think we'd get from him.
Sure. So the Supreme Court is skewed age-wise. For the most part, the liberal or moderate liberal judges are old. older, the oldest justice being John Paul Stevens, who was appointed by Gerald Ford and is in his late 80s, although seems to be fit as a fiddle for a man in his late 80s. He's on the top of everybody's list as someone who might retire. He already spends a lot of the term in Florida, although he's working very hard from there. He has an email and a fax machine and so forth. After that, it's probably Ruth Bader Ginsburg, appointed by President Clinton. She seems to be in good health, knock on wood, as well.
But Judge Souter has also indicated that he might like to retire, and clearly the kind of judges that Barack Obama would nominate would be less conservative than what McCain has said he's likely to nominate. Michael Dorff, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Michael Dorff is a professor of constitutional law at Cornell Law School. He is also a former clerk for Justice Anthony Kennedy.
I mean, what a seat for history, to be clerking for Kennedy.
No question. If anyone's read Jeffrey Toobin's 9 about the Supreme Court, you can just imagine what it was like for the professor there.
Stories to tell.
We'll have him back.
Just talk about Kennedy. Yeah.
Exactly. We have 4 hours every day. There's room for him. Right now, there's room for Femi Okeh. He's got a few headlines for us.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. In Europe, markets are reacting to news that the Dutch government will invest more than $13 billion in banking giant ING. And market futures are up before the open in the United States. Meanwhile, three top executives at the French bank Caisse d'Epargne have resigned. The chief executive says he's taking full responsibility for the $800 million loss the bank posted last week. Barack Obama had a good day yesterday. In addition to announcing that he raised a record $150 million last month, he also picked up the endorsement of Republican Colin Powell. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's party isn't quite ready to sign off on a new deal on the U.S. troop presence in Iraq. A draft agreement is set to go to the Iraqi cabinet, but the ruling Shiite coalition says that they want to make some changes first. One of the most controversial issues is whether American troops and contractors will retain immunity from Iraqi law. And a lander exploring the terrain of Mars is reaching the end of its days. The Phoenix will not be able to survive the freezing temperatures of the approaching Martian winter. And the main investigator, Peter Smith, hopes the lander will have time to investigate just a few more questions in the soil samples it's currently digging up.
We'd love to be able to claim that we've found organic materials in the northern plains of Mars, and that's a key and most important ingredient of our search. However, it's also the hardest thing to find, and we're pushed right down to the wire in our last samples to try and make that case.
And a Martian winter, temperatures dropped to -108.
Hey, don't count
Fahrenheit.
Phoenix out. They've counted Phoenix out before.
Maybe it can survive the dust storms,
could
the
happen.
-180
could
Fahrenheit
happen.
Temperatures,
Go
the
Phoenix.
Snow.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, with the extraordinary headlines about the economy and the financial sector, it makes sense that people are interested, and we've been deluged with emails on a whole variety of subjects. But last week, we got a very interesting email from someone named Vicky Rovere, who begins her email with the phrase, "Although I'm reasonably bright, I'm pretty stupid when it comes to financial matters." And then she goes on to suggest a couple of things Americans might do to change the course of the economy. Well, we were so interested in her suggestions, and they raised so many economic issues at once, we decided to bring in an economist to talk about them. And joining us here in the studio is Dr. Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University. Also, Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Director of Business Week, is also here with us. Thanks, Dr. Sachs, for joining us.
Pleasure.
Let me read you what Vicky Rovere suggested here. Would Americans be open to an appeal to their patriotism? You know, we heard about the Marshall Plan, you know, during World War II. What if millions of us entered the stock market and put in an amount we could afford to use? I could scrape together $100. It's not enough to open an account, but I could find a friend who's already investing and ask her to invest it for me. If millions of people did this, would it make a difference? That was her first suggestion. Second suggestion is even more interesting. It's been explained that the reason the money freeze is going on is because the general population doesn't have the ability to get loans, and small businesses don't have the ability to get loans. What if local people created a money pool locally that would be available to small businesses to get loans? They could pay you back in goods and services, no interest expected. When your neighbors built your barn years ago, they didn't charge. They just knew it would get them the same kind of help when they needed it. Thank you for your kind attention, says Vicky Rovier, who's a listener here in New York City. Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, can mobilization of people's sort of patriotism, you know, move the economic needle in some sense?
I think patriotism will be needed to have our nation come together on some long-term solutions, because we're in a bit of a mess. But once a bubble has burst in housing prices or in stock prices that were at levels that they shouldn't have been at, except for being artificially pumped up by cheap money and a sense of euphoria, you can't just patch that together. We can't make the housing prices go back up to levels that they shouldn't have been at in the first place.
Well, but let's talk about the sort of ground-up issues that Vicky raises here. You know, you've been you've had a great profile in the Millennium Fund initiatives at the United Nations, which are very much global, even though they involve local initiatives. Does the Millennium idea scale down to the level of communities where people can pitch together, put together a fund that might get bank loans become available to small businesses in people's communities? If people put up that kind of money, would it have an impact? We're always talking about the savings rate of people in Japan and how much that's supportive of their economy.
Again, we have a banking sector to do that. We have to get it back to health. It's good when we have local banks investing in local communities, to be sure. But the big problem right now is that our banks, on a very large scale, took funds heavily from abroad and use them to lend for a housing boom that wasn't justified by the ability of the borrowers to repay. Now those loans have fallen bad. Housing prices are going down, and we're going into a recession. I think people should understand that it's hard, of course, and it's, however, not the end of the world. We have a cyclical economy. The economy is going down after being badly and artificially pumped up by Alan Greenspan for many years. He made bad mistakes. The regulators made bad mistakes. There will be a period of unemployment. The budget deficits will widen sharply in this country. Where we're going to need patriotism is to come together on solutions to redirect the national economy, to help poor people that have not been helped by the Bush administration, to help people get health care, to help people transit to new, long-lasting jobs, in building infrastructure that this country desperately needs, in a new sustainable energy system that doesn't destroy the climate. So the key for us, actually, is not to try to recreate a Bush-era bubble, which burst and was not sustainable, but to create an effective, fair economy in the future that is environmentally friendly and internationally competitive on the right grounds. Mm-hmm. That's going to take many years, but we need a completely different economic approach. And I think that that's why we need a lot of change right now.
But you would agree on the individual micro level that people saving money, perhaps not necessarily loaning it to local businesses, but households saving money is something that you argue. Obviously, governments need to save money and to pay their bills and become more efficient. But as an individual, we're not necessarily good at savings in the United States, so that would help, right?
Well, of course, what happened in the last few years was that households borrowed very heavily. They borrowed against their home equity. They borrowed to buy houses. They had negative saving rates because they thought that high home prices would bail them out. High home prices have now become low home prices. They didn't get bailed out. Households are squeezed. Now they're cutting back their consumption. They are raising their saving rates. But in the first instance, what that does is contribute to the economic contraction itself, because home building is going down and purchases of automobiles and other appliances and consumer durables are going down.
Well, quickly, Jeffrey Sachs, I mean, poor Vicky Rovier says the only thing she's been asked to do in this crisis or asked not to do is to not panic. And she kind of wants to do more. Can you just think for a moment? We're going to get some headlines. Can you think for a moment about, you know, what it is that she might actually do?
I think that she has to take care of her personal finances to be responsible. She has to be a responsible citizen now, supporting the kind of long-term, realistic economic change that we need in this country. But I'm afraid that there's no simple individual remedy to a bubble that has burst.
So tough words for our listener, Vicky Rovier, but hang in there. Jeffrey Sachs, thank you so much for being with us. Jim Ellis is still with us. Jeffrey Sachs is an economist from Columbia University. And now headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. We've got the S&P up 14 points. The Dow is up 100% at the moment. Investors will be listening as Fed Chair Ben Bernanke testifies to Congress today. He's expected to discuss interest rates and the possibility of a second stimulus package. Meanwhile, President Bush will examine how the financial crisis is affecting Main Street. He's taking part in a round table discussion with small business leaders in Louisiana. The trial of Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens may go to a jury today. He's accused of concealing more than $250,000 in gifts and home renovations. Seven NATO ships have arrived in Somalia to tackle piracy in the region. Pirates have attacked more than 60 times there this year. The NATO fleet will protect ships carrying food aid. And do you remember that Ukrainian ship off the coastline of Somalia?
Sure.
Pirates still in charge.
Incredible.
Amazing. NATO airstrikes killed 20 militants in a weekend-long attack just west of Kabul. And that area has become a stronghold for insurgents in recent months. The Tampa Bay Rays are off to the World Series for the first time ever. And they beat the Boston Red Sox in a 3-1 win last night to clinch the American League title. And they host the National League Championships against the Phillies starting Wednesday night.
Thank you, Femi.
Thanks,
Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And with me in the studio are Jim Ellis, Assistant Managing Editor at Business Week, and Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, an economist from Columbia University. And on the line is Vicky Rovier, our listener, who posed the question, what can Americans with patriotic instincts who want to help the economy do? Vicky, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
And we brought Dr. Jeffrey Sachs in to respond directly to your question. Did you hear an answer in there?
Well, I heard not anything reinforcing my ideas. Obviously, he's got answers, and I did like his emphasis on helping poor people. But I'm talking about not necessarily solving the problem as a whole, but making a dent in helping individual people. And in fact, I just heard a story that Code Pink, the women's anti-war group, had an appeal from a woman who was about to lose her home, and they put it out as an email and managed to raise enough money to save her and going to continue supporting her until she can get back on her feet. So that I think that as a viral thing, if folks know that that kind of thing is going on, then they can think about applying it to their own situation.
Do viral initiatives work in your view? Is it a new methodology, Dr. Jeffrey Sachs?
I believe that Vicky's right that communities need to stick together. People need to help each other. Given the scale of what we face of millions of people in trouble right now,
and maybe
this is going to have to be a responsibility of government to a very large extent, but this doesn't mean that people don't act as good neighbors and good helpers in their own community. It does mean that we need government now, and
right.
We haven't had responsible government during this whole 8 years of the Bush administration.
Well, let's put the Bush administration aside for a moment.
It's maybe, hard to do,
maybe,
but
I know, it's hard for Jeffrey Sachs.
We actually need to do that on January 20th, 2009.
Okay. All right, fine. But we all are aware of the campaign. Jim Ellis, maybe the issue then for Vicky, the takeaway, patriotic takeaway for Vicky, is let's empower government to enable communities to take action and maybe be incentivized to do some of the kind of things she's talking about.
I mean, basically, basically the the best thing we can do is to let our representatives in Washington sort of know what our own objectives are and what our priorities are, and that then enables them to put money behind what we ought to go at. If on a completely micro basis, I mean, the difficulty is the scale. There's just too much wealth that's been lost and too much money that's needed. But, you know, if you really want to do something good, there are, you know, you can buy, let's say, muni bonds in your local area. That right now the muni bond market is very troubled. You know, places like
municipal bonds. Right, that support all kinds of infrastructure.
California last week appealed to its citizenry to buy its bonds because they were going to have to pay a lot more money if they sort of floated the entire thing out in the marketplace. And 80% came from small investors. New York City is going to have a bond issue soon. So there are things like that. And also a lot of social services agencies are going to drop now because they're losing money because of stock losses.
So, Jeffrey Sachs, there are ways for people to participate in sustainable initiatives and the regrowth of infrastructure by being a part of these bond programs. Yes?
I think adding to the social services would be something I would really emphasize.
Well, thanks to both of you for coming down, and particularly Dr. Jeffrey Sachs. Thanks so much for being with us. Vicki, how do you feel?
I'm mixed. I'm sort of like, as I said, I have trouble dealing with a financial issue, so I'm not quite sure how
to
apply
well,
what I've heard.
You're not stupid, that's for sure. You're a takeaway listener. You asked a question. We got you some answers. Thanks so much for being with us. Vicki Rovere, Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, and Jim Ellis on The Takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 20th. Femi Okeh has the latest headlines.
Thank you very much, Adora. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Markets have been open for a few minutes, and right now the Dow is up around about 70 points. Global markets are up as well. Major Asian and European indices are up. General Motors and Chrysler could be one big company by the end of this month. Several press reports say that both sides want to close a merger deal soon, and they've been talking for some time. If the deal goes through, the combined company would control more than a third of the US auto market. In Turkey, a right-wing group is charged with provoking chaos in an attempt to overthrow the ruling party. The trial, which started today, is chaotic in its own right. Officials had trouble trying to seat all of the 86 defendants and their lawyers in the same room as hundreds of people demonstrated outside. The Republican presidential candidate, Senator John McCain, has been distancing himself from the administration of President George Bush. At a rally in Toledo, Ohio, he sought to counter his Democratic rival's charges that a McCain presidency would continue the policies of the last 8 years under President Bush.
We have to act immediately. I said it at the last debate. I'm not George Bush. If Senator Obama... Senator Obama wants to run against George Bush. He should have run for president 4 years ago.
Joe Biden was campaigning in Tacoma, Washington on Sunday, but it didn't stop him from teasing his friend about not being George Bush.
There's an old expression made famous by Shakespeare. He doth protest too loudly.
Today on the campaign trail, Obama is in Florida, John McCain is in Missouri. And finally, Mr. Richard Blackwell has been terrorizing celebrities for decades. Before he started his worst-dressed celebrity list, he was a very little-known designer. And he started talking about Hollywood fashion disasters back in the 1960s. And sadly, his acerbic criticism has ended. Mr. Richard Blackwell died yesterday at age 86.
Well, you'll never make the list for me. Thank you for...
Not now.
Thank you for that, yes.
Although I do hear that he said you had a dress sense for radio.
Yes, I certainly do, and that's why I am in radio. So regarding the economy and some of the details that Femi gave us there just in the headlines, you know, a lot of people talk about the federal deficit, but not many people do anything about it. That's the political discourse about the deficit, but it's clear that the Wall Street bailout and all of this financial crisis is going to have a very big impact on the federal deficit. What does it mean? Well, we asked New York Times economics reporter Louis Uchitel to come and talk about the causes and consequences of this massive deficit. Louis, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we've been talking about this bailout and the financial problems, and one of the things we haven't really mentioned is that the federal deficit, because of all of this, and it's hard for me to keep track of the arithmetic with $700 billion here, $80 billion there, the deficit is going to spike. How much of a deficit do we think we're going to acquire in the next few years?
Well, the year we started on October 1st, just this month, it's going to spike to about $700 billion. And as a percentage of our entire economy, our gross domestic product, that sort of rivals it's about 5%, which is more or less where it was in the late 80s when we were so upset about deficits. Now we're not upset at all. The deficit is the lesser of the evils, and every politician seems to have come to that conclusion. Let's deal with the economy and the banking system, and we'll worry about the deficit some other day.
Quickly, what's the immediate consequence of that deficit on financial markets?
I don't think it has any consequence one way or the other. Financial markets are going to be steered by what happens to the banking system and what happens to the economy. The deficit is of minor importance. That's partly because financing the deficit, it can be financed in this environment of a weak economy at low interest rates. But I think the financial markets would be upset also if we decided to cut spending in order to accommodate the banks and really sank the economy.
Well, it's interesting. Maybe through this whole financial mess, we're going to learn what the deficit really means, even though it's talked about over and over again. Louis Uchitel, thanks so much for that quick update.
Thank you very much for having me.
Louis Uchitel is a New York Times reporter. Jim Ellis, we're going to give you the last word. The deficit spikes to 5% of GDP in the United States. No biggie?
Well, people can't care the way they did in the 80s simply because now we're talking about the viability of the financial system. I mean, you've got to decide what comes first and whether it's making sure we have a financial system that we can continue to tweak over the next 100 years or, you know, getting the deficit together.
So a leak in a boat is a big problem unless the boat is on fire, in which case you don't worry about the leak, right?
A great analogy.
Good? You could rip it off. You can use it there in Business Week. You want to?
Okay.
And I guess John brings up a point, which is all of this news for your average consumer like me, I mean, it can get really overwhelming. In your estimation, how should I be looking at these new numbers every day that say something terrible about what's happening in the economy?
Well, I think that the typical person needs to say, you know, things are bad and therefore the security blanket I've had over the last 5 years, particularly that's debt-based, is going to have to go away. I mean, a lot of people could give consumers lots of credit simply because they could sell that credit off in these giant securities that they would mainly peddle to people outside the U.S. That market is drying up. A lot of that's never coming back. A lot of people who were able to buy homes who traditionally would not have been able to and got subprime loans, they'll never be able to buy homes again. We've got to adjust to that. People will have to basically prepare for an age of diminished expectations.
So this is a lifetime event. I mean, Jeffrey Sachs, as he was running out of the studio, said, get ready for a steep recession. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know if I'd say as steep as it will be long. I mean, it won't be as steep as it could have been simply because over the last couple of years, companies have been extremely tight on inventories. Inventories are one of those things that make people say, what in the hell is that? But what it means is that most of the impact of a recession is when businesses have so much stuff on shelves that they suddenly have to lay off people, stop production, and then it makes you run into recession.
So we have lower inventories in this new economic era.
Because you've got technology that allows you to manage it.
That's interesting. Well, Jim Ellis, gosh, I can't tell you how great it's been having you right
Absolutely.
Here in the studio with us.
Absolutely. Many thanks.
Well, thank you.
Jim Ellis is assistant managing editor at Business Week with some sort of negative news there. But there's good news on the markets, right, Adora?
There is. Markets are very slightly up this morning, which is to say they're not down. And right now, people are gathering on Capitol Hill awaiting testimony from Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, who is scheduled to speak in about 10 minutes. Also later, we're expecting a statement from Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. That's supposed to happen somewhere around 11:30 a.m. For some thoughts on what to expect, Wall Street Journal's market beat blogger David Gaffin joins us now. Good morning, David. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. What do you think investors are looking to hear from Bernanke this morning when he speaks?
Well, I think they're hoping he doesn't scare them, which is what he seemed to do last time out. I think that he's going to deliver yet another sort of stern warning that this economic situation is not going to be resolved particularly quickly. And, you know, we'll get a sense of how he feels as far as that, as far as how the various different lending facilities they've put in place over the last several months are going along. I think that those are sort of the main topics that he's going to end up hitting. Once again, you know, the economic situation remains, you know, a bit unsettled, more than that, really. And so
certainly after last week with all those wild fluctuations.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you this. Bernanke has been called to testify on Capitol Hill. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson is choosing to give a statement around 11:30 a.m. Any significance that he's talking on the same day that Bernanke is, and what do you expect him to say?
I think that, you know, there's going to be, they tend to both talk a lot. So, you know, I don't want to put any extra significance on the fact that he's going to speak just as Bernanke is speaking. But what he's supposed to talk about, that is Hank Paulson, is about this capital purchase program, just regarding what the banks are going to be doing. And I think that once he, you know, gets through that, there'll be just a little bit more clarity and detail. As far as a sort of, you know, market reaction, I don't know that I see something kind of, you know, coming out of that necessarily, unless he drops some kind of bombshell.
And quickly, David, last question. What should we be looking out for today or any day this week?
Well, I think, honestly, you know, as the markets tend to, you know, revert to some kind of normalcy, and when I'm talking about markets, I'm actually talking about these credit markets, the funding rates that people are thinking about, where banks lend to each other overnight, which has been sort of the big bugaboo of what's been going on lately. What I think it is that people will be looking at those things as they approach normalcy, which they're slowly starting to do. So it's that, and then the second thing is earnings, because this is a big week for earnings.
A big week for earnings. We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much.
David Gaffin, Wall Street Journal's market beat blogger. I called it a bugaboo.
We're always on at The Takeaway, and we're talking about Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack Obama. What did you think?
I wondered if anyone had commented on the encouraging irony that the fear that the Bradley effect would undermine the candidacy of an African-American politician may have been neutralized by the endorsement of another African-American politician.
Well, that's an interesting thought. Let us know what you think. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. All thoughts are welcome. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.